This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The new movie, Birth of a Nation, tells the story of Nat Turner's slave rebellion in the 1800s.
What time do you think it is?
5:30.
By now, I'd be two rows down, half a bag full. I'd be getting ready to feed the stock.
Not today.
No, sir. Not today. Brethren, we've been chosen. Our brothers and sisters, they waiting on us.
What are we gonna do?
We'll fight.
Rebel!
That's from the trailer of The Birth of a Nation. The film received high praise earlier this year when it premiered at the Sundance Film Festival. After the festival, the film company Fox Searchlight bought the movie for a record-breaking $17.5 million. The Birth of a Nation opened in theaters nationally earlier this month. Controversy surrounding the film's writer, director, and lead actor, Nate Parker, has clouded the movie's release. 17 years ago, Parker was charged with raping a young woman while he was a student at Penn State. After a trial, he was acquitted of the charges. How Parker's past influences The Birth of a Nation is just one of the topics we'll talk about today on this month's installment of Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. And joining me, as always, are Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Mark is a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University. He's an author and host of the webcast Left of Black. Welcome back, Mark.
How you doing, Frank?
I'm doing well. Natalie, a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Hello, Natalie.
Hello, Frank.
So, Mark, take us back. Walk us through this controversy with Nate Parker over his film, The Birth of a Nation.
So he makes a film, you know, Nat Turner's kind of the classic black revenge film. The story of Nat Turner was a classic black revenge tale. And so there'd been a lot of anxiety about what that would look like in the big screen. And obviously when it's bought for $18.5 million, it wins all these awards. There's a lot of excitement about it. You know, this comes after 12 Years a Slave and other quote-unquote, you know, slave cycle movies that we've seen the last couple of years. And then what we find out is a story about sexual abuse, rape, in the case, accusations against Nate Parker, as he's gone on to talk about over and over again. You know, he was found not guilty. But even 17 years after the fact, had no sense of remorse or no sense of understanding conversations about consent from his very adult point of view, from where he might have thought about this when he was, you know, 18, 19 years old. So that's clouded the reception of the film. There have been conversations about boycotts. The conversation about boycotts are interesting because, I think film functions very differently than, say, musical genres, right? If you want to boycott an R. Kelly CD, you're boycotting R. Kelly. If you boycott a film, there are lots of folks who have their hands in the pot in the making of a film. And I'm sure there are folks, you know, who are like, I'm going to boycott the film and not know that someone in their family is working as a grip.
Yeah.
You know, this, right. I mean, that's just what the reality is. And those conversations have not been connected to actually real conversations, I think, about addressing rape and sexual violence. There was a football player, I want to say he either played for Tennessee or Indianapolis, that in response to all these conversations, he, in fact, you know, donated money to get rape kits processed. I think that's actually much more critical work to be done than necessarily boycotting a film.
And Natalie, this is complicated by the fact that he was indeed acquitted, but still a lot of questions about what part he played and what actually happened. And so the question really surrounds how he is talking about this case now, given the way anybody from the outside might be looking at it.
Exactly. And I think that because the public had access to transcripts from conversations that Parker had with the victim, the extent to which you read that or you read the articles and interviews with the victim's brother, sister, there's a lot of information that was put out in the public sphere about this. And it's kind of hard to wrap your head around what is and isn't legitimate. But, you know, at the end of the day, it goes back to, I think, what Mark said about how Parker is handling this right now. And I think that he seemed to be on a trajectory to actually show growth and evolution and an understanding of how serious what he had done still is, especially given the fact that the victim committed suicide a few years ago. But then he kind of doubled down on this, I've been vindicated. I was acquitted. So I'm not going to apologize, and I'm not going to basically do any more work on myself around this issue.
And here he is on 60 Minutes talking with Anderson Cooper.
You haven't apologized to the woman or family. Do you feel that you have anything to apologize for?
I'll say this. You know, I do think it's tragic, so much of what's happened, and the fact that the family's had to endure with respect to this woman not being here. But I also think that, you know, and I don't want to harp on this, and I don't want to be disrespectful of them at all, you know, but, you know, at some point I have to say it. You know, I was falsely accused. You know, I went to court and I sat in trial. You know, I was vindicated. I was proven innocent. I was vindicated. And I feel terrible that this woman isn't here. You know, and I feel terrible that, you know, her family had to deal with that. But as I sit here, an apology is a no.
Now, that was a clip from Nate Parker with Anderson Cooper from 60 Minutes, an interview earlier this month. I'm talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Mark, what do you hear in that response?
Someone who really hasn't processed the fullness of what sexual violence and rape is, about what for many men is an unclear line about what consent is. And simply because the law didn't deem you guilty doesn't mean that something didn't happen that we all recognize as rape and sexual assault. And I imagine in some ways, and you know, I don't know Nate Parker, so I can't necessarily know how he's thinking. But, you know, when you see the act of rape and sexual violence that's off screen, that powers the narrative, that becomes the stimulus, right?
In his film.
In his film, you know, not historically, but in his film. Yeah. For, you know, the revolt, you understand that he's someone who might think in his mind that whatever sexual violence he was accused of, you know, 17 or 18, 19 years ago, it is not something that is comparative to the violence that he responds to in the context of the film. He clearly, I think, has made a decision to weigh different forms of sexual violence and rape differently. And I think it's his shock at how Black folks have responded, those folks who've been critical of him, I think is in response to that, right? He doesn't understand why Black folks, you know, particularly Black women, particularly right. Millennial Black women, draw a very strong line about what sexual violence is, whether or not the victim is Black or white, and whether or not the quote-unquote rapist or accused rapist is Black or white.
Well, go ahead, Natalie.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, there was an interview that the writer Brittany Danielle did in Ebony with Nate Parker. And that was, I guess I feel like he started walking towards an understanding. He says in this interview that he talked to various writers. I think he at least read what women who were very critical of his stance on his trial and rape culture in general had to say about it. Roxane Gay wrote a pretty scathing article in, I believe it was the New York Times. There were quite a few other articles that just were not feeling him, you know, just to put it bluntly. But in this Brittany Danielle interview, he seemed to be moving towards an understanding of how his lack of understanding about consent and what his goals were with women as a 19-year-old, how they speak to rape culture. He seemed to be on his way to that. What happened in the interim is, I think that's the thing that bothers people, is that he seemed to be processing this and trying to evolve to get to a place where he could say, you know what, I understand that even though I was acquitted, what I did and the way I thought about women at that time is it contributed to a culture that is complicated by sexism, patriarchy, all these things. And I'm sorry about that. I mean, I think people would have been accepting of that sort of response, but he just dialed it all the way back. And I think that's where people began to to say, you know what, I can't go to see the film. That's what kind of did it for me.
Well, let's talk about the critique about the way rape is positioned in this film and how it often is the genesis or the jumping off point, the impetus for the rebellion. There's been a lot of outcry about that, the use of rape in this film.
When I saw it, I felt like that was a part of the impetus. But thinking about how Nate Parker has sort of operated and behaved in the public sphere as we've gotten closer to the release date of Birth of a Nation and the things that he has said, and then watching the film and seeing the role of women. I mean, gratefully, we don't see the rape scenes. They're not graphic. We miss all that, thankfully. But these women are not, they have no agency. There is no power that they have. And so I kind of feel like Nate Parker is setting himself up in the character of Nat Turner as the savior.
Yeah.
And I think that's problematic.
That has been part of the critique, Mark, that this is about saving women who have no agency and no power on their own.
And we've seen historically some of the things that have empowered black men to take control of communities has been under the guise of protecting black women, right? Protecting the sanctity of black womanhood, right? And of course, what we've seen in this particular historical moment now is a kind of pushback against that kind of thinking, you know, black women attempting to define what their own identities are outside of the context of a black respectability that is to this idea of black men being protectors. I think what's so interesting about the rape scene or the lack of the rape scene in the film, it's almost ironic because so much else of the violence in the film, it is so on your nose that it's interesting that he chose not to present that particular scene on your nose also.
Yeah. Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, Back Channel, connecting culture and context on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. There's more just ahead. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and I'm talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this installment of Back Channel. And today we're talking about a number of films. We're still talking about The Birth of a Nation. Let's talk about the film, Mark, and the impact of that film itself and the story that it tells.
I've been joking that they should rename the film Marvel Presents Nat Turner. The violence is so on your nose, as I said before. It feels very much like a millennial telling of this particular story, right? The violence lacks nuance, the terror lacks nuance, and it's odd in the sense that, you know, they've been hit so many folks, right? Because you get the feeling that someone like Nate Turner is saying that, you know, what's going to make this film different than previous, you know, films about slavery is that we're actually going to be able to depict the authenticity of the violence. But, you know, if you go back and you look at, say, Halle Garima's film Sankofa, which for me, 25 years later, is still the film that I go back to over and over again to tell the story of African enslavement, part of it is about nuance because people are living this violence in real time. They don't need to consume it on the movie screen, particularly in this moment where so much of the violence against black bodies is mediated in terms of visual culture.
Yes.
You don't need to see that on the screen. So I think it very much speaks to this idea in a world where we live in Superman, and even Luke Cage's and the X-Men and all these kinds of folks. I mean, that's where Nat Turner fits. And I'm sure not all those choices were Nate Parker's. I'm sure some of those choices were coming from Hollywood. It's like, if we're going to tell this story, we're going to create this kind of heroic figure, and we could imagine action dolls and things of that nature, you know, had the controversy not bubbled up the way that it had.
Does it have the effect, though, of bringing our attention to a retelling of a story that for a long time had only been, the sort of white narrative of this vicious attack on unsuspecting and, women and children in plantations? I mean, it was, and in fact, the trial itself, you know, when you look at the record of the trial, there was not a lot of evidence there. So all of that stuff that had been buried for a long time, is there any way in which even the comic book telling of this story through a different narrative and a different set of eyes helps us understand the story any better?
I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about what did I learn? Like, what did I get from this film that I didn't sort of already know? And I'm not sure. I think Mark makes a really interesting point about the millennial telling. Because I think that's what I felt, that it was not nuanced, that it was you know, pretty much I'm telling this story and, you know, there's going to be some gore and I got to, you know, put this in. Right. And it was, I have to say, it was beautifully shot. I mean, and it was beautifully acted, but I'm not sure how much the film contributes mm-hmm. to our wider understanding mm-hmm. of what slavery, you know, what actually happened. And even of Nat Turner's story, I feel like I'm missing something that I need to really understand how important and revolutionary that rebellion was.
Well, let's take a look at another film, this one a documentary that does take a look at a very complicated and difficult situation, and it is with some nuance and deeper understanding. And I'm talking about the documentary 13th that looks at the 13th Amendment, its connection to an era of mass incarceration. Here's a bit of the trailer.
The 13th Amendment to the Constitution makes it unconstitutional for someone to be held as a slave. There are exceptions, including criminals.
The loophole was immediately exploited. What you got after that was a rapid transition to a mythology of black criminality.
Some people got the real problem.
Animals. Beasts that needed to be controlled.
You better believe it.
I'm only human.
It became virtually impossible for a politician to run and appear soft on crime.
The kinds of kids that are called super predators.
Millions of dollars will be allocated for prison and jail facilities.
Three strikes and you are out.
There's a clip from the new documentary 13th. It's actually from the trailer. My guest, popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal, today on Back Channel. Mark, what is the? This is a documentary that definitely tries to connect the dots and take us back to the origins of what we now call the prison industrial complex and mass incarceration.
It's an important documentary, right? Because you know Ava DuVernay at this point in time has such weight. Gravitas, if you will, mm-hmm. you know, amongst Hollywood, obviously, but also amongst, you know, regular rank and file black folks. So to be able to tell this story, you know, Michelle Alexander laid the foundation, you know, with the new Jim Crow. And for folks who weren't going to get through that book, you know, this is kind of a visual representation of it. And it explains so much, this shifting bar of what gets deemed criminal, right? You know, after the Civil War, but even thinking about these photos of, say, Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, you know, taking jail photos in the 1960s. So even progressive figures get criminalized in different kinds of ways. And so we understand then what happens in Ferguson. We understand what happens in Baltimore, both in terms of Freddie Gray, but also the young woman who gets killed, you know, in her apartment this year.
Right.
We understand all these shifting kind of dynamics and even how black folks have contributed to this dynamic with pushing for, say, anti-sagging laws. You know, so you have black men who are being incarcerated and given fines more likely, you know, for sagging that they can't pay. That ends up leading into the kind of incarceration that we see in places like Ferguson.
Yeah.
And to be clear, what we're talking about here, the 13th Amendment, which of course was the amendment that outlawed, constitutional amendment, it outlaws slavery, but it has to be careful in its wording because you will also outlaw,
prisons,
you'll have to outlaw prisons if you say nobody can be kept against their will. So they say, you know, but except for prisons. And of course, white society picks up on that pretty quickly. I mean, it starts with, you know, in sharecropping, where sheriffs would just pick up, wait outside of drink houses during harvest time, incarcerate a group of black males.
For loitering.
And drunken, disorderly, whatever. They're out drinking right. The same way they were in the white community, but I was hanging out at the black drink house. Who did I put in jail? And then, wouldn't you know it, a magnanimous white landlord will come by, take you out of jail in exchange for your services on the field during harvest time. That's where it starts and it doesn't end.
Right. And, you know, the whole idea of the current situation within the prison industrial complex, the fact that we have prisoners, like, you know, there is a monetary interest. There's a capitalistic interest in maintaining a certain number of prisoners. So then, you know, that just adds to the criminalization, because if we don't have enough prisoners to do the work, like to have these people that are in prison making things for different companies, and you know, they're learning, I guess, a trade in so doing, but it's free labor, so there's not that much difference between what is going on now and slavery. I mean,
You remember 15 years ago, Natalie, where, you know, everyone was talking about the way that long distance phone cards were used.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were in prison, you had to pay these exorbitant rates,
right,
in order to make phone calls. And it was a way for long distance phone companies to be able to make money off
the
prison.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has their hand in the pot in this regard at this moment.
Right. But look, the argument is the 13th Amendment, all it did was just allow for prisons to remain. It didn't say that black people had to be in them. Why is the population, if you stop breaking the law, you won't be in prison? That would be the pushback against 13th.
I think because it also serves certain kind of political goals, right? Because on the one hand, you're talking about the siphoning of free labor, but it's also folks who are taking away from the electorate.
Right.
You know, folks who can't vote, folks who can't impact on the governing of both their local and state and in some cases the national, you know, communities. So it's incredibly complex. I mean, you could accuse white supremacy of a lot of things. White supremacy is not stupid.
Right.
Right. In fact, white supremacy is quite brilliant, right, in terms of the kind of things that it created in this context. You know, one of the things that the film reminds you of, you know, we don't talk about places like Parchman anymore. You know, Parchman was one of the most famous prison farms. You know, it's interesting watching, The Birth of a Nation. They showed a trailer to August Wilson's Fences. And I'm remembering my first introduction to Parchman was watching August Wilson's piano lesson. And that's not, you know, a place that resonates for us anymore, but it's firmly in this history, right? Every, you know, major federal prison or private prison in 2016 is essentially a version of Parchman, you know, in the 21st century.
Mm-hmm. And when you take a look at the way the criminal code is written, I mean, you have John Ehrlichman's admission that the Nixon, beginning in the Nixon administration, they sought to criminalize those pleasures that were predominantly in African American communities. It was a deliberate effort. He said, look, we can't just throw black people in jail, but we can criminalize their activity. That's a quote.
Right.
It starts there. Then we see the disparity between powder cocaine and crack cocaine.
Right.
You understand all of that. And then on the other side, you crash an entire economic system, and you have Brooksley Born at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, head of the commission, saying, President Clinton, unless you get these swaps under control, right, you have to regulate these. We have to outlaw these. They're going to crash the system. They were not outlawed. Mm-hmm. So what you outlaw and what you don't outlaw, what is legal behavior and what is criminal behavior becomes critical to the question of who's in jail, who's not, and who the system worked for.
Absolutely.
And I think this is something that Ava DuVernay, who we talked about this in an interview with the New York Times, her experience, and I think in even putting together Middle of Nowhere as she began researching that, it was her experience on the streets of Compton that led her to this kind of conclusion.
I grew up in Compton in a beautiful black and brown community, and there was a very, very heavy police presence. It wasn't uncommon to ask, hey, where's Derek? Oh, he got locked up. Where are you going? Oh, to see, you know, my daddy, you know, visitation. I can't go to the thing because I'm going to see my PO. Just a part probation, imprisonment, parole being a real part of the fabric of life there. And so that's something that's been on my mind for a long time. That coupled with, I think, making Selma and being really in tune with the parallels between the civil rights movement and the Black Lives Matter movement and really seeing, police presence and imprisonment and crime and punishment as a through line to those and wanting to impact that.
Filmmaker Ava DuVernay talking with the New York Times earlier this month. I'm talking with popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this edition of Back Channel. How important is it, or what do you make of the fact that this was issued as a streaming video on Netflix?
I think that's important. I mean, it responds to the way that we're changing the platforms in which folks can access this. You know, because if there weren't these streaming platforms, this is a film that would circulate in big cities, elite theaters, and very few black people would be there. And it would do a certain kind of labor in terms of informing a liberal white left. But in terms of the masses of folks being able to consume it, it changes everything. And yes, Netflix is making a bunch of money off of it, but that's part of the trade, right? How do we get our ideas into the marketplace of ideas? We sometimes have to, do deals with the devil like Netflix in order to be able to have that happen.
And I think that Ava DuVernay, I'm figuring she's behind this effort, circulating on Facebook, at least, there are clips from the film that depict different parts of the story, and there's a really powerful montage of images that utilizes Donald Trump's speeches from this election season, intercut with footage of a black man and black people being brutalized by police or by white vigilantes, to show the connection between what we have in terms of a mob mentality against black people today and then what was going on, you know, in our history. And that those connections are so important. But I think what Mark is saying is so true, that if we didn't have the streaming platform, it would not be accessible to the people who really need to see it. And I'm not even sure that the people who really need to see it, right, who would then understand something about the system that has, for centuries, criminalized black people for a specific reason by design. I don't know that that is, that the people who really need to see this, so that that point is driven home, will get to
see it. And driving it home is the hard part, right? If you get back to the Nat Turner story, you talk about this story, it does have to do with what the received narrative is and who gets to tell the story.
Yes.
And I think, Mark, that's some of the deeper and more difficult challenge here, is to get people to understand that the received story is written by people who didn't think credit default swaps should be illegal, and therefore nobody committed a crime in crashing an economic system for the whole globe, but selling an ounce or 2 pounds of marijuana would be a felony.
Right.
That understanding how you came to embrace those things as equivalent and okay is the central problem, and that's, no film can really do that. Although, fascinatingly enough, I'd love to play this clip, because this is a clip of James Baldwin, and he's in a debate at Cambridge University William Buckley Jr., right? And they're debating at Cambridge. But here is Baldwin, in fact, talking about this kind of system, and how, if once you embrace the system and never question how you come to believe what you believe, everything then flows quite naturally from that.
It comes as a great shock around the age of 5 or 6 or 7 to discover the flag to which you have pledged allegiance, along with everybody else, has not pledged allegiance to you. It comes as a great shock to discover that Gary Cooper killing off the Indians when you were rooting for Gary Cooper, that the Indians were you. It comes as a great shock to discover that the country which is your birthplace and to which you owe your life and your identity has not in its whole system of reality evolved any place for you. The disaffection, the demoralization, and the gap between one person and another, only on the basis of the color of their skins, begins there and accelerates throughout a whole lifetime. So that presently you realize you're 30 and are having a terrible time managing to trust your countrymen.
That is James Baldwin in 1965. It's actually part of a debate with William Buckley Jr. at Cambridge University. Is this documentary sort of part of that story of helping us all understand, change the narrative, or at least asking critically how it is we came to believe what it is we believe?
I think so. I definitely think that, first of all, I'm so grateful that Ava DuVernay is the one telling the story, because it matters who is telling the narrative. And I think that the film has the potential to serve as a shock, as a way of waking people up to the realities of what we are presently dealing with, and where that comes from, and the fact that it's always been here. I posted about 13th on Facebook a week or so ago, and one of my Facebook friends was like, I fear that the people who really need to see this will not. And so I was like, you know what, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna like do a search for Trump, and I'm just gonna go and insert this little clip into conversations. But I think if we have learned anything about the Donald Trump campaign and the people who follow him and think like him and believe in what he's saying. It really doesn't matter. Like, if you were to see, if they were to see 13th, I'm not sure it would make much of a difference. In fact, I think it would be rigged or lies or what have you.
Just stop breaking the law and you won't be in jail.
Exactly. Yeah.
Except to be called the 28th instead of the 13th.
Right.
I think the narrative point is important because, you know, not everybody's going to be able to commit to watching a documentary. And that's why it's important what Aver's done on multiple platforms. So Middle of Nowhere is a conversation about the prison industrial complex.
Yeah.
One of the strongest themes throughout Queen Sugar is a commentary about the prison industrial complex.
Right.
Even when we think about something like Luke Cage, you know, Luke Cage spends a fundamental time thinking about what happens to black and brown bodies in prisons.
Right.
And so this is an important conversation. You know, when you talk about the historical legacy of slavery and your good liberal white friends say to you, well, slavery is over, you know, the thing that you get to point to now, in fact, is the prison industrial complex. And that is what is empowering black creativity in this moment, trying to give some language and narrative understanding, theoretical understanding of how prisons function in the lives of black folks.
Does it translate to political action? How does Black Lives Matter fit into this?
I think we've started to see this, you know, going back to Chicago back in the spring when they knocked out a district attorney because of her practices and brought in another one. And hopefully they'll be able to, because, you know, you could get people out, but you can't hold people accountable unless you help get them in.
Right.
Unless, of course, your name's Obama, but it's a whole nother conversation. But I think, you know, if folks are thinking about how this stuff functions, not on a national level, that's important, obviously, but how this stuff functions on the ground in the everyday, in your city council, in your state legislature, your senators, your congressmen, your mayors, I mean, if you're dealing with those folks around these kinds of issues, then I think that's where Black Lives Matter can impact what we're seeing in terms of the prison industrial complex.
Talking today with popular culture experts Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown on Back Channel, Connecting Culture and Context. We'll talk more about Luke Cage, the bulletproof black superhero in a hoodie, that and more when we return. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal on this installment of Back Channel. And we are looking at the new Netflix show Luke Cage, about a bulletproof black man. Tell us more about the origins of this hero, Mark.
Comic book hero, you know, out of the Marvel world, you know, in some ways Marvel responding to shifting demands in terms of consumption after the Black Power movement. Clearly a response to the popularity of folks like Superfly and Shaft in terms of black exploitation. So it's, you know, this character that has existed on these pages for such a long time that now has come to life, you know, through a Netflix series starring Mike Coatler.
Let's take a listen to a little bit of this. This is Luke Cage. He's talking with his friend Pop about his superpower.
You should be out there helping people, that's all. Like them other fellas downtown.
Reaper used to say the same thing.
Yeah, well, she was right. You don't ever think about all the people you could help? You should be more ambitious.
What if my ambition is to sweep hair, wash dishes, and be left the hell alone?
Well, that would be a waste.
You think I asked for any of this? I was framed, beaten, and put in some tank like an exotic fish. Came out with abilities.
Saved your life.
More like ruined it.
There's a clip from the new show Luke Cage on Netflix. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal today on Back Channel. So what about this? I mean, they talk about nuance. This is a comic book hero who dates back to the 70s, but Mark might say appealing to millennials anyway. Natalie, is this just a, you know, sort of another adventure series, or does it have some kind of social impact?
I think it has social impact. I have not watched the whole first season, but I think that the writers are doing something with black females. They're powerful characters, which I think is something a little different. I think the fact that Luke Cage comes from a community, essentially, where there's Jessica Jones, who is a sexual assault survivor. There's, I can't remember the name of the character, but the one who is blind. So we're dealing with sort of the margins of society being empowered to, you know, have agency and do good and do like really good work in the world. And I think that's important because that adds to, I think I heard Roxane Gay, the culture critic, say that, you know, it allows people who are physically challenged or who are rape survivors or who are Black to see themselves in a way that they're not typically seen. And I think that's very important.
I think the reference that I immediately draw when I see this particular iteration of Luke Cage is Avery Brooks playing Hawk, you know, both on Spencer for Hire and also the series A Man Called Hawk. And this is now 30 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. And he was another bald-headed Black man with a goatee. You know, he had a gun, but he wasn't bulletproof. You know, the difference here, of course, Luke Cage is bulletproof. And I remember Brooks saying that when he did the series that, you know, he wanted to make sure that he created such a layered reality to it that folks would get something out of it other than the standard narrative. And he's like, you know, if they give me the opportunity to do one episode, right, I'm going to pack so much in that one episode that folks are going to get so much out of it. You know, ironically, he only did 13 episodes, which, of course, is the first season of Luke Cage. But the beauty of the show is that it celebrates a Black community in Harlem, and it's so densely layered. So you can pay attention, right, to some of the narrative, and the narrative is interesting in a kind of nominal way, but it's all these deep cultural references to African-American literature, to African-American music, you know, harking back to the 1990s and a series like New York Undercover, where there was a fictional space called Natalie's, and all the top hip-hop and R&B stars of the 1990s would play a set in the context of the series. They've recreated that whole idea with the idea of paradise. So, you know, you get to see folks like Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, who you rarely will see on mainstream television in any kind of way. You get to see Raphael Sadiq. Yeah. I mean, there's a kind of richness, and this a lot of this goes to Chio Coker, right? Who, of course, is the showrunner, you know, well known for 1990s hip hop journalism, right? And so, what you have in Luke Cage is the 1990s hip hop head fantasy, right? These are kids who were listening to hip hop, listening to A Tribe Called West and Public Enemy, right? And Ice Cube, and reading Luke Cage comics, right? And so all of this world comes together. And you see this most explicitly where every episode is named after a Gangstar song, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Natalie.
I wanted to ask Mark something, which is, if you remember when Shaft and Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song mm-hmm. came out, mm-hmm. There was a New York Times critic, a Black man, who basically said or posed the question, what will Black people find more beneficial, the painful truth of Sweet Sweetbacks or the beautiful lie, essentially, of Shaft? And to me, Luke Cage, in some ways, begs that question. What are we talking about, a beautiful lie, a Black man who can stop bullets and is bulletproof? Or are we talking about something that's a little more nuanced and deeper, something that we need to unpack?
Yeah, I think there's clearly a kind of Afrofuturist bent to this, right? I mean, this is kind of an imagining of a Black world as it doesn't exist. And some of it's romantic. Some of it is aspirational. But, you know, even as Luke Cage is bulletproof and, you know, spoiler alert here, you know, at the end of the first season, he ends up back incarcerated again, right? He's back in custody. Mm-hmm. So even with all these powers, right? And again, part of this, you can argue that he has a sense of integrity about who he is and the truthfulness of his experience, right? That you know, he's willing to take the risk to stand on that, even as it has him going back, you know, to the penitentiary. So I think it's a combination. I think in many ways, what you get is kind of this combination of Superfly and Shaft in mm-hmm. that regard. Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. it's aspirational, but also representational.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
You get all
absolutely.
Of that in the same thing. But the idea that if you draw the characters well enough, if they're authentic enough, even if they're superheroes, bulletproof Black man in it, that doesn't mean they're not realistic in the sense and authentic in the sense that they carry their context with them. That becomes the storyline in some ways. You don't have to beat me over the head with the themes because
right.
now I'm seeing people driven and having to make choices in a context that may not be familiar to me.
Right, right.
And or maybe terribly familiar to me.
Right. right? And I think, I mean, I appreciate what Mark said because I think that there is something to be said about seeing a Black male character who is bulletproof when given everything that is going on around us and many Black males who are clearly not bulletproof, right. who have been killed by law enforcement. That bulletproofness of Luke Cage becomes an integrity. It becomes a character that, right. And I'm talking about character as in like what's inside of you that I think is definitely representational and different and something that we haven't really seen.
And subtle embedded Absolutely. Cultural references. Here's another clip from the series.
Lemonade. Popular drink.
And it still is.
There we go. Lemonade. I thought it was iced tea. Sorry, I couldn't resist. So sorry. But tell us why lemonade is
so. It's a
here.
Short little reference, and they kind of give you a little hint to it because it's from episode 9, and episode 9 is named Dwick. And Dwick, you know, arguably might be my favorite gang star song. But there's a line in Dwick where Guru goes, "Lemonade is a popular drink, and it still is." Mm-hmm. And again, Jay-Z uses that same line, you know, when he contributes to a remix of All the Way Up, and he makes reference to Beyonce's Lemonade, right? That's the line in which he does it, right? So again, it's like this kind of densely layered thing that, it, in some ways, is just, you know, Chio working in passing, mm-hmm. right? But for folks who are really committed to the culture and deep in the culture. They're going, mm-hmm. right, this was something
right,
for
they're
me.
Hearing it. Right. Yeah.
Brings all that forward. And also literary references that are you know, spotted throughout the series. So here's another clip again from Luke Cage.
I just never got into Donald Goins.
Are you crazy? Donald Goins was a street poet.
I didn't say Goins isn't. Walter Mosley? George Pelicanos? Boom.
I bet you into Richard Price.
I dig Price. Dennis Lehane, too.
What about Chester Himes?
Without question. My biggest beef with Donald Goins is that he wrote about criminals and he died like one.
You don't have to get all Fox News about it. Goins invented Kenyatta, the best black hero this side of Shaft.
There you go. Clip from Luke Cage on Netflix. I'm talking with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Niels. We're talking about literary types, literary heroes here, and Shaft, all in the same sentence, and not to mention Fox News, so pop culture references as well.
Well, I also, you know, when I first listened to this clip, I noticed the jazz in the background, mm-hmm. and is that mm-hmm. Miles Davis? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that right. to me, that there's another layer that's inserted in there because they're in Harlem. I mean, this is black music, original black music. So there is a lot going on.
And this is the thing that was important to me about that particular scene. You know, this is occurring in a barbershop, right? And barbershops are these sanctuaries of black masculinity. And we've been told, right, and we can use examples of someone like Floyd Mayweather. You know, we've been told that we're looking at two generations maybe of black men and boys who don't read. And not only does this scene show us that, in fact, that they do read, but they're right. reading a range of things, yeah. right? The fact that he can make a distinction between Donald Goins or an Iceberg Slim or Chester Himes, he's reading, literally has a Walter Mosley book in his hand, but he also knows who Richard Price is, right? And of course, Richard Price, who writes Clockers, you know, writes that narrative about what the drug trade looked like in the 1990s, the very drug trade that in large part is responsible mm-hmm. for Luke Cage mm-hmm. in this iteration being in jail in the first place. Mm-hmm.
We've been talking about the connection between Luke Cage and music. Let's look now to other music news and change gears a bit. Solange Knowles released a new album called A Seat at the Table last month, debuted at number one on the Billboard charts, and here's a clip from that.
Don't touch my hair when it's the feelings I wear. Don't touch my soul. It's a rhythm I know. Don't touch my crown. They see the vision I've found. Don't touch what's there. When it's the feelings I wear, they don't understand what it means to me. To go where we meant to go. They don't understand what it means to me. Where we chose to go.
There's a clip from the song Don't Touch My Hair, Solange Knowles. My guests are popular culture experts Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. Natalie, unpack this album for us. What are you hearing in terms of songwriting and production in this album?
Phew. Well, you know, I feel like this is an album that is so interesting given who it is. This is Beyoncé's little sister, right? So, you know, Beyoncé has given us Lemonade. She's given us the Beyoncé album, these visual albums, right? She is a solid pop icon. And then here's her little sister, whose sensibilities clearly are draw from what Beyoncé draws from, but she does something with them. Yeah. She's like an alchemist, and she turns them into something that is, you know, just, I think, very refreshing. I love the fact that there is, it's so spare. The production is not so dense and slick that you can't, that the music, the lyrics, and her voice get lost. And you know, I didn't know, I didn't really know much about where Solange got her inspiration from. And so learning about the influences behind this album, songs
she
like...
She released a playlist, didn't she, yes, with her influences? So we know about it, yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, she's got everyone from Sun Ra, you know, which is about as Afro-futuristic in terms of music as you can get, to Sarita Wright, who was like Stevie Wonder's muse and
right,
and
Black
sing
Navy, yeah,
right, and even D'Angelo. I mean, there's and then there are other sorts of influences. There are literary influences. There are pop culture influences. But I really love the beauty that comes from the sparsity, and I feel like she's depositing something into the universe. You know, whether you like it or not, I think really doesn't matter. I think that what matters is that she clearly has committed to being authentic to who she is and to what she's hearing in her head, and that's what she's offering to us.
If breaking news is a metaphor, if the idea of breaking news is a metaphor for how we consume culture at this particular moment, and that would include even Lemonade within that context, I think what Solange represents is a slowing down of culture,
mm-hmm,
right? The slow cooking of culture,
yes,
if you will, right?
Yes.
So you see that in terms of A Seat at the Table. That's what Queen Sugar is about.
Yeah.
You know, it is these certain Black creative folks and other creative folks who are thinking about, you know, that, you know, they want to create something that's going to have some substance and some longevity, and it's not simply going to be treated as something, you know, that, you know, you're not going to be interested in a year from now, right? You know, when you think about the differences between, you know, Solange and her big sister's album, you know, the genius of Lemonade is, in fact, the visual aspects of it, right? The music is good. It's okay. There's not a whole lot of those songs that I think I'm going back to a year from now, right? I could imagine listening.
I'm going back to.
but there's a way in which, you know, I think musically what Solange does, and part of it is because of what she's drawing on,
yeah,
right? Is she's drawing on timeless references, so the music itself has a kind of timeless quality to it.
Yeah. But this idea is fascinating. We've got a little time left, but the idea of slowing things down, if you're talking about trying to change a perspective, mm-hmm, change a way in which you understand your story, then slowing things down and showing things in a different, you know, a different number of pictures per frame is one way of doing that, right?
Yeah. Right, and that's why even Beyoncé's gesture towards Julie Dash's Daughters of the Dust in Lemonade was important, because what so many folks who saw Daughters of the Dust during its first run responded to is that it was so slow,
mm-hmm,
right? This is an era of New Jack City and all these kind of boys in the hood, and you know, you had to sit there and sit with those characters and sit with the language and sit with the ideas. So we're starting to see cultural workers now like Solange and also like Ava DuVernay, who is pushing us in that direction.
Yeah.
Well, we have run out of time, so unless we slow down the clock in a way that I can't do, we have to stop. My guests in this month's Back Channel are Mark Anthony Neal, Natalie Bullock Brown, Mark, a professor of African and African American Studies at Duke, author and the host of the webcast Left of Black, and Natalie Bullock Brown, a professor of film and broadcast media at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh. Thank you both for being on the program today.
Thank you so much.
Frank.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.